Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have the Week in Review, we'll talk Amazon, and we'll also talk about what to expect in the last couple weeks of the mayor's race, including growing frustration over the lack of mayoral debates.
This is voter suppression, and I want to be...
Suppression?
It is suppression.
How is it voter suppression for the mayor to not debate?
The engagement, and I have to say this, the engagement that is needed for people in the city of Boston... I believe has suppressed, and it's the reason why we only saw 50,000 people come out in a major American city on September 26th. That's real.
Also today, why isn't the rest of school more like kindergarten? An MIT professor says for success in the 21st century, all of us need to look at learning as lifelong kindergarten. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Friday. Time for the Week in Review. And let's start with the more than two dozen New England bids to be the home for Amazon's HQ2. Here's Worcester's pitch.
Alexa, compose an email.
What's the message?
Hey, team. I think I found the city for our second home. Let me tell you about Worcester, Massachusetts.
And from the Merrimack Valley.
They don't make buildings like this anymore. Why? Because they have character, just like the Merrimack Valley.
I think I want to marry you.
There's our friendly neighbor to the north.
New Hampshire has all the benefits of Boston without the headaches, without the traffic, without the taxes, without the bureaucracy, but still being able to draw off the most talented workforce pool in the world.
Yeah. Well, Boston says...
We do not imitate, for we are a marvel to others.
The gratuitous John F. Kennedy tape there in the Boston pitch for Amazon's HQ2. So joining us to discuss the Week in Review is Tom Keene. He's Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Tom, it's good to see you again.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Tiziana Deering. She's co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's good to have you too.
Hi there.
I love all the bids. I'm not sure who I would pick if I were Jeff Bezos, but let me just start off with, this is inspired by what you asked me during the newscast break, Tom. If you had to make a call right now, who Amazon might pick, who would you pick?
So I think they would probably go up north to our neighbor in the north, Canada and Toronto.
I like that. That would be my call too. But why?
I think geographic diversity and genuinely national diversity. I think Toronto is a great city, beautiful architecture. It probably has a great pool of smart workers. And it avoids sort of the problem of having to pick among the United States and get all of the other cities jealous.
Mad at you. Tiziana, you had an interesting thought about Toronto, too.
Well, I guess my thought with Toronto is that one thing you don't have to do there is worry about visas and bringing in workers from other countries the way you do now in the United States. And why, if you've got a growing tech industry business, why would you pick a place that gives you that headache?
Yeah, it's currently less politically fraught, for sure. Okay, so Toronto gets 3 votes from this Boston crowd here. But let's talk about... The New England pitches a little bit, and actually also how all this has come about. I mean, what do you guys make of the fact that we have more than two dozen bids coming from New England? I mean, that's a lot. Is it a signal of regional strength or kind of a scattershot approach to bringing a major company to the region? Tom?
It seems to me it signals a regional weakness, not a strength. This is actually our problem, which is that we've got all these individual little cities and towns, no regional government or anything like that. And so everyone goes off scattershot. You can see that in our development in general. You can see that in our approach to this. And by the way, it's contrary to what Amazon asked for, which is somewhat of a unified bidding approach.
Oh, okay. Interesting. We've done exactly the opposite.
Right.
Tiziana?
Well, I want to start by saying that I don't watch The Bachelorette on purpose. And so having to just participate in this reality show parade. It's driving me a little nutty in the first place. But in addition to that, I actually see it as appropriate and a strength because at the end of the day, A, Amazon probably has a pretty good sense of what they want. B, they're not going to either say, oh, wow, I couldn't see the Merrimack Valley because we just only saw a proposal from Boston, or that's it, you didn't comply with the rules. Boston was actually our first choice, but since Massachusetts submitted the Merrimack Valley as well, we're out of here. I mean, none of that's going to happen. So if you've got different regions that want to make different cases, why not allow them to do that and see if Amazon bites? My guess is they have a short list already anyway. They're just using this as competition to try to sweep
Well, exactly. So let's talk about that for a little bit, because I don't know, maybe I'm not smart enough to fully understand this process, but I really want to know why Amazon is even doing it this way. I mean, it's a huge company. They've got massive resources. They could, even if they wanted to put people on the ground in all 50 states to find out the locations that were best for them, they could do that. Is this really just one of those giant races to the bottom, Tom?
No, I think it's actually a really smart thing on Amazon's part, because what Amazon has done, if they pick someone first, then that person all of a sudden thinks they have to be wooed and can now demand more and more out of Amazon. Here, it's the opposite way. The cities are trying to woo Amazon, and they're coming up with, in Worcester's case, you know, lots and lots of financial incentives. And Amazon's got to be delighted to see
stuff
like that.
But that's the race to the bottom part, though, isn't it?
Oh, well, it's the race to the bottom in terms of the cities and towns. Yeah. But from Amazon's point of view, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Tiziana, your thoughts?
Well, takes me back to
the Bachelorette. Exactly.
Right? It does feel like a race to the bottom. And, you know, the other thing that drives me nuts about this, and we've seen this in lots of other examples, anytime you get into a situation where you're competing for association with a for-profit company, the value that anything other than the for-profit company brings to the table is devalued. Right? Mm-hmm. The value of our roads and bridges, of our talent pool, of our infrastructure, of our corporate and business culture here, of our civic engagement, et cetera. So you wind up racing to the bottom to try to bring a corporation in, which devalues all of the assets that you're bringing to the table. I think Tom's right that from Amazon's perspective, this is a smart way to go. But from a city and town's perspective, it actually doesn't then allow you to come to the table as an equal partner and say, let's talk about what's mutual.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Yeah, and actually, I want to give some kudos to Boston at this point, because I actually thought Boston's proposal was really not a race to the bottom. We didn't go out there offering tons of money. We went out there selling ourselves, talking about the educated workforce, sort of talking a little bit over the transportation system and the,
and the
cost
housing.
Of housing. Yeah. But it really was a really well-constructed proposal that was trying to be somewhat co-equals with Amazon.
Well, to that point, let's hear a little bit from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. We talked with him here on Radio Boston on Wednesday. That's when he gave me that wink about wink, wink, Suffolk Downs, East Boston. And we spoke with him before the bid was actually made public, which it was today. And here's what he said about why Boston's current bid, underscore the word current, does not include any tax incentives.
We didn't put any tax incentives in this piece right now. I mean, some cities did. There was one in Massachusetts that put a $500 million incentive.
Worcester.
Yeah, it's too early in the process. You just don't know what exactly it is that you're building yet. So we'll get a chance now, if we get to the next round, to see what cities were chosen, what their bids were like, and to see really what we're up against.
So interesting and smart response there, because the mayor's also saying he's open to actually doing tax incentives, doing bidding if Boston gets through to later rounds. He's obviously done that before with GE. Tiziana.
Well, yes. And I do agree that the mayor tried to come as equal a partner as possible, except that he did leave the door open. And we all know that if there is a second round, there will be discussions about tax incentives. I find that particularly ironic, given what we've heard about GE in the last 24 to 48 hours and the strains that that company is under and the concerns that it raises about the long-term return on investment for the tax breaks and other incentives given to them to come here. I guess at the end of the day, it does make sense to do smart math, and where there are smart trade-offs, one should make them. And if tax incentives is a part of that, so be it. But there is a dynamic in this situation that feels a little more coercive than I think would be ideal for all of the parties involved.
Okay, so let me just jump in here, because this takes me back to the other thing, which I was like, it's not often that I disagree with Tiziana, but I do hear a little bit. Because, okay, Boston aside, because it's kind of a unique entity in New England, but, you know, I think it actually may be worth it for New Bedford, Fall River, Worcester to do what they can to get a giant company and the 50,000 jobs that would come with it. You know, imagine what that would mean for Worcester. So maybe offering the most competitive tax incentives they can is a good idea.
So So I'm not sure I buy off on that. I think what happens is when you start off, when the foot forward is tax incentives, you're really saying you don't have a lot else to offer. And Boston, I think, was really saying we have a lot to offer. And if at the end of the day it's some money to get us over the line, yeah, we can talk about that. But that's not why a company, quite frankly, is going to move
in the
to
long
any location.
Run, exactly.
In the long run, this is going to be trivial stuff. What they're really going to care about is the workforce and about the environment that's going to be there. I do think in terms of all the other places that put their foot out for Amazon, I can't believe that the Merrimack Valley, for example, really thinks it's going to get Amazon and the second headquarters.
Oh, we ought to be hearing from it. Send me a tweet at Radio Boston, guys.
But I don't think it's a worthless exercise because Amazon continues to expand. And by making their name known and by saying, hey, you know, maybe this is a distribution center or some other satellite office, they're part of that mix.
Okay,
yeah,
Tatiana.
And what I do like about that piece of it is not just Amazon, but everything from, you know, the Worcester bid, the Fall River, New Bedford bid, all the way out to the Grand Rapids, Michigan bid. What it does do is tell other businesses of a smaller scale, but who may also be looking for a new place to be, about all these other American communities that have some ability to really support great industry and innovation. Mm-hmm. And I do like that part of it.
So we here at Radio Boston are obsessed with comparisons and comparing hypotheses to known data sets. And there's one known data set in terms of what is it like to have Amazon in your city, and that is in Seattle. So we actually also this week spoke with two long-term Seattle journalists about how much Amazon has changed the city of Seattle, which it has a lot. There's more than 40,000 people who work in downtown Seattle because of Amazon alone. They're the single largest owner of high-end office space in the city, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So one of those folks that we talked to is Joni Balter. She's a longtime Seattle reporter, and the effect of Amazon in Seattle, here's how she said some Seattleites describe it.
Armageddon is one word that we use for it.
Armageddon, she said, because the changes have been so big. And on the one hand, yes, city coffers are full, she says. They got a lot of money. But on the other hand, housing crisis, horrible traffic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Joni then also told us, I said, hey, you know, for the cities and towns out here that want to are vying for Amazon, what piece of advice would you give us? And she said this.
What do you wish for?
What do you wish for?
And be careful what you wish for.
So the what do you wish for part was interesting to me because I wonder if like the finalist cities will be gutsy enough to say, hey, Amazon, actually what we really want is we want a commitment for you to build 50,000 units of housing for us.
Right. And I think the problem that the city that gets Amazon is going to find is that it will almost certainly be the largest employer and, just like in Seattle, own the most real estate and, as a consequence, will be in a position to be able to really negotiate hard with that particular city. And then there's something else for cities to think about. It's a competitive marketplace out there. Yeah, Amazon's huge right now, but we're in a world of technological change where, you know, the big companies of today may be gone 3-5 years from now, and you really don't know what's going to happen with Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in a Midwestern town where there was one big corporate employer, mm-hmm. and during my childhood, that employer threatened to move their headquarters if the city didn't actually annex several other townships and do some other pretty extreme things that the people didn't want, but that the corporation did want. And I think I've been affected by that in my life by seeing once a large corporation comes in, it is really important to develop a sense of shared vision, shared planning, shared objectives, shared investment, because otherwise the leverage is so tremendous that a town or a city can be somewhat consumed by the corporate agenda if there isn't some balance in that relationship.
Right.
And when there is, it can actually be very positive for all the parties involved.
Right.
We don't want to become Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Oh, good point, both of you. Okay, well, we could talk about Amazon forever, but let's not. Let's instead move on to the fact that we just have a couple of weeks to go until Election Day. So it means it's the final stretch of the race for mayor for the city of Boston. This week here on Radio Boston, we talked with both Boston Mayor Marty Walsh for an hour and City Councilor Tito Jackson for an hour as well. And there were some fireworks, I have to say. Tito Jackson just yesterday came on and he told us that he was very unhappy that there haven't been that many debates in this mayoral race. Thus far, there's only been one, actually. And Councillor Jackson told us he had a problem with that.
This is voter suppression, and I want to be
suppression.
It is suppression.
That's your how is it voter suppression for the mayor to not debate
the engagement. And I have to say this: the engagement that is needed for people in the city of Boston I believe has suppressed, and it's the reason why we only saw 50,000 people come out in a major American city on September 26th. That's real.
And September 26th was the day of the preliminary election. Tom Keene, your thoughts?
So suppression is such a loaded word, and clearly Tito should never have gone in that direction.
But he was trying to make a deeper point.
He was trying to make a deeper point, but two observations. First of all, the voter turnout that you had for this election was kind of similar to the voter turnout you have in a lot of preliminary elections in Boston where there isn't really a lot of fireworks going on, and that's what was going on in this case, including if you go back and look at some of the preliminary elections under Tom Menino. That's point one. Point two, it's not the other candidate's job to get your voters out for you. It's not Marty Walsh's job to get Tito Jackson's voters out for him. That if Tito can't get them out, then that's his fault, not Marty Walsh's.
But Tiziana, Tom makes good points, and in fact, that was part of my pushback for Councillor Jackson yesterday. I said there has to be some responsibility on the part of voters to want to engage in the democratic process. But on the other hand, to the councillor's deeper point. Look, I'll throw both my hands up. I'm in the media. Of course I want as many debates as possible, and we haven't had a lot. We've had one. There's one next week. I mean, is the councillor not right to be raising the alarm here?
Well, I think I would like to separate those two things.
Okay.
If there is a concern that there's not enough discussion about real issues that affect voters going on and that we haven't come up with sufficient mechanisms to do that, yes, I think the more we get issues discussed, the better for the city. Contested, truly contested elections are good for everyone who runs and for everyone in the community. And so to the extent that the councilman may be feeling frustrated that this doesn't really feel like a contested election, I certainly understand that. Debates are one mechanism. They're one vehicle. There are many vehicles to contest an election and raise issues. And from an instrumental perspective, what's in it for Mayor Walsh to do more debates? I mean, it would be very hard to bring him to the table to do that. He's not behaving exceptionally here. Anywhere that you see big polling differences and a candidate, an incumbent who's dramatically in the lead, usually they try to have as few debates as possible.
Right. Okay, so to that point, I think we had an example when I talked with the mayor on Wednesday, and I talked with Councillor Jackson just yesterday on Thursday. But we saw on Wednesday with Mayor Marty Walsh maybe why he doesn't want to participate in that many debates. And there was a moment where we were talking about policing in Boston, and I asked him a question that came in from a listener. We have another question that came through online from Alex, who asks, why haven't you responded yet to the policing questionnaire put out by the ACLU, Digital Fourth, and other civil liberties organizations?
I have no idea. I'll have to check and see.
Your campaign manager sent a letter back to the ACLU saying that you wouldn't respond.
Oh, I don't even know. I don't even know about that.
Okay.
It might have been based on, and let me think, are we taking another break yet?
We're going to take a break in about a minute.
I'll find out after that, and I'll comment after the break.
So the mayor did find out, he called his campaign and found out why they didn't sign or fill out the ACLU's policing questionnaire. And he said when we came back after the break, he said it's because they didn't feel like they had to. A lot of the questions were already, in the mayor's word, slanted towards his administration's policy on policing. And then I said, well, okay, well, why don't you answer them now? And I asked him one of those questions. Some of them are yes-no questions. I've got some of them right here in front of me.
Do
you want to answer them?
No, I'm not going to answer right now.
Why not?
Because there's other questions we didn't do.
But why? I mean, but it's just they're yes-no questions about policing.
Give it to me.
Okay, I'll give you. They're not hard. If reelected mayor of Boston, will you prevent the Boston Police Department from obtaining military weaponry such as machine guns, armored vehicles, drones, bayonets, or grenade launchers from the U.S. military?
Yeah,
yes or no?
We've been very clear on that all along. I actually made a public statement against that, and I thought that I criticized other police departments around the country for doing that.
Okay, and then the mayor went on, and I asked him three or four of the other of the ACLU's questions, and he answered them all in good faith. But the reason why we wanted to play all that back is that is the kind of stuff that should be happening in debate. And I think people ought to be hearing what both candidates' policies are on important things like policing. And we haven't had that much of that kind of discussion in this race, Tom.
No, and we clearly have not. And as a general proposition, you're absolutely right, which is that if we had two relatively evenly matched candidates, you would be seeing a lot more of that kind of discussion. The problem here is that Marty Walsh is way ahead of his opponent. Tito has not been able to raise anything in the way of significant campaign cash to be able to mount a very effective campaign. And even in his district, he ended up losing to Marty Walsh in the preliminary election. Walsh is feeling very confident. At this point, he does kind of a Rose Garden strategy. He's just not going to rock the boat at all. He doesn't want to. Every debate is an opportunity for him to get tripped up. So he doesn't want to participate in debates. Every questionnaire is an opportunity for him to be nailed on a point he'd just as soon not answer.
Do you know what this makes me think of? That the bigger issue here is one that Boston has had for a long time, and that's the depth and breadth of its pool of potential of folks who could rise to be not. And this is no slant against Councillor Jackson at all. I'm thinking more broadly. Like, why don't we have more competitive races in the city is what I'm asking.
Yeah. I don't think the answer is the pool of candidates.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the nature of local politics and a few things that have gone on with the mayor and what a mayor is today. First of all, the role is largely administrative. And as a consequence, if you can keep the streets clean and plowed and so on, you're going to be okay and people really don't have a hook to go after you. The second thing is it's really tough in a local election to be able to raise campaign cash.
Yeah.
The people who contribute are typically people with business before the city. And the one thing that, and their contributions are public information. So the last thing they're going to do is go up and give money to a challenger and find themselves ultimately frozen out when the incumbent wins yet again.
The Globe's done some good reporting on this, yeah.
Yes, and therefore, people who serve as the mayor of this city would have to change the behavior of the last 70 years, which is to not freeze people out when they challenge a sitting mayor, because they'd have to value contested elections that then raise the kinds of issues and bring forward the kinds of questions that you just brought forward. And it's not going to happen. And so it does create this incredible pressure to just maintain the status quo.
Yeah. Well, in the interim, this table and these microphones are always open to the candidates. They can come lock horns with me anytime. I'm not sure if that's good for the city's democratic processes as a whole. But anyway, so we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to above the fold, as they say over in the newspaper world, but are worth a mention anyway. So, Tiziana, you go first. Your hubbub.
Well, it's been a week where we've talked about women's empowerment very much. And just for the record, hashtag me too. By the way. But in the process, there's been another conference that's been happening this week that was hosted by Mothers for Justice and Equality, which is an organization that brings together women who have lost their sons to violence on the streets and work on social change and advocacy today. They have brought together people from all over the country who are working on these issues, who have experienced loss and taken that loss and turned it into solidarity and social action. And in today's environment, I just think it is the coolest thing that as we're here doing this, they're in Boston doing that and bringing those kinds of voices together in such a positive, productive way.
Absolutely. That's a great hubbub.
Thanks.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Tom Keene.
So the internet nearly broke this week over a photo of a Bridgewater teacher dressed in 17th century garb, surrounded by two white children, holding a leash to a black child kneeling on the floor. The echoes of slavery were unmistakable, and people were outraged, and justifiably so, except for this. The woman wasn't a teacher, but rather a reenactor from Plymouth Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene depicted was a custom from back in those days of teaching toddlers to walk while holding them to a tether. The black child had volunteered to pretend to be the toddler. And similar photos involving white children pretending to be part of such a family scene are readily found. So what should the adults here have actually done? Should they have refused to allow the black child to pretend to be a toddler? That would have ensured this controversy never arose, thereby protecting the adults from criticism. But the kid would also have learned a lesson, that because of his skin color, he can't play the same games as his white peers. That, I think, would have been worse. I get that these are racially fraught times, but it's worth considering that before we jump to condemn, we pause to try and listen and understand.
Okay, this is a really good hubbub too, but I have a solution. Don't put the picture on the internet.
That's
the most obvious one, but it's the one that I think people think of last/ they don't.
Right.
Right? Because you're right. It took a perfectly innocent educational moment and turned it into something that it didn't need to be. And I mean, the internet. Okay. So good. Excellent. I love that hubbub. But don't put it on the internet, people. Just don't.
Because everything's out of context.
Okay. Right. So, but my hubbub also is internet-based, social media-based, much, much, much lighter. Okay. This is a tweet that is in the process of breaking Twitter, like right now, real time, before our very eyes. And it comes, it's like the best thing I've seen in all month. It comes from someone who calls himself on Twitter Edge, and Edge only has 1,090 followers. Edge is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And Edge tweeted this just yesterday, tweeted this. Dot at KFC, so the Twitter for Kentucky Fried Chicken or KFC, follows 11 people. Those 11 people, 5 Spice Girls and 6 guys named Herb. 11 herbs and spices. I need time to process this. And I checked, and indeed, KFC only follows 11.
It's
Jerry
true.
Horner, Melanie Brown, Mel C, Victoria Beckham, Herb Scribner, Herb Dean, Herb Waters, Herb Alpert. Absolutely, 11 herbs and spices. Best tweet ever. Whoever works for KFC social media deserves a raise,
brilliant,
a promotion.
Brilliant.
This tweet right now, 248,583 retweets, 547,512 likes. Oh my God, the number just went up. 249,000 retweets. Edge. You knocked it out of the park. That is my hubbub for today, and I'm so glad to end on a little bit of good, light news. Tom Keen, former Boston City Councilor, it is always great to have you. Get better, okay?
I will. Thank you.
And Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. Always great to have you, too.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Kindergarten is fun. Kindergarten is play. Kindergarten is projects with finger paint, blocks, costumes, books, and gears. All of which means that kindergarten is naturally creative, complex, and collaborative, just like the real world. So why then is the entire rest of a child's conventional education totally not like kindergarten? And could that be why we're not doing the best job we can educating kids for a rapidly changing world where creativity and the ability to collaborate effectively may be the greatest indicators of success? Well, that's what Professor Mitchell Resnick has been exploring for years at the Lifelong Kindergarten Lab at MIT, and he lays out his work in the new book, Lifelong Kindergarten, Cultivating Creativity Through Projects, Passion, Peers, and Play. And he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. And I've actually wanted to talk to you for quite some time, so I'm delighted that this book is out at the moment. But Professor Resnick, let me just start with a basic question. Like, what is it about kindergarten and what they do that you find so compelling or effective as a teaching tool or methodology?
I think if you think of the traditional kindergarten, kids spend a lot of time playfully creating things in collaboration with one another. They may be building towers and castles out of wooden blocks or making pictures with finger paints and crayons. Yet in the process, they certainly learn some important concepts like structure and stability when they build a tower. But more important, they're learning about the creative process, how to start with an idea, create something, play around with it, experiment, share with others, and get new ideas. So I think they're really developing as creative thinkers, and that's what's so important.
And you call this like a creative spiral.
Right. I see this spiral where kids, they start with their imagination. It starts with having an idea, but it's not enough just to have an idea. You know, the kids might think of a fantasy city, but then they pull out the wooden blocks to start building the city, and they start experimenting to see how tall they might build a tower. And they start working with others, and someone works on the building, someone works on the roads. The building might fall down. They start reflecting. And as they start thinking about why did that work, not work, it sparks new ideas, and the spiral starts again. So they constantly have ideas, experiment, share, and then new ideas over and over.
Well, and yet you write in the book, and your research is predicated on the notion that after kindergarten, in most schools, there are some exceptions, of course, but in most schools, this entire model of projects, passion, peers, and play, as you write about it, and your research shows, it goes away.
Yeah. And in fact, in some ways, it's even worse than that. Right now, you go into many of today's kindergartens, and kids are filling out phonics worksheets or training on math flashcards. Kindergarten in many places is becoming more like the rest of school. What I want to do is exactly the opposite, to make the rest of school, the rest of life, more like kindergarten.
But have we ever had in the history of American public education, have we ever had a time where the basics of kindergarten or the basic approach of kindergarten has been in the higher grades? Because I feel like so much of how education is set up comes out of the Industrial Revolution.
Right. And I do think generally schooling was established to prepare kids for life in an industrial society, oftentimes working in a factory. And it wasn't trying to spark creativity and help them develop as creative thinkers. But as society has changed, schools have not. So schools are really out of sync with the needs of today's society, where because things are changing so quickly, just learning a fixed set of facts or skills is not good enough. You need to learn to think and act creatively.
Okay, so this is so fascinating to me because I want to be perfectly honest and transparent. I'm deeply sympathetic to what your research shows and what you're writing about. But I also want to note that sort of preparing kids for the real world and what's out there in the 21st century is obviously a major and perhaps the primary goal of public education. But at the same time, right now, within the sort of K through 12 world, there are these other forces at play, the force of accountability, seeing like, are we actually effectively teaching kids? There's the force of trying to close the achievement gap. These are also very, very important things. But right now, the tools we have to attack those two problems, I feel like they're the opposite tools. Like, how would you do that, but also have projects, passion, peers, and play? Like, how do you measure this success?
I think part of the problem is that there's a good reason for accountability. It's important for us to know that our schools are being effective. It's important to give feedback for teachers about what methods are working and feedback to students about what they're learning or where they might have misconceptions. The problem is that with a lot of current focus on standardized testing, we end up focusing on the things that can be easily measured.
Right.
Unfortunately, the things that I think are most important in a child's development are not so easy to measure quantitatively. So there's this mismatch that we're applying a certain type of assessment that's not matched with what I think the goals of education should be. So we're stuck in this situation that we end up valuing the wrong things in our school system. Now, there still is a challenge. How can we then be sure that kids are developing as creative thinkers, as I think is important? It's not an easy thing to measure quantitatively, but we can document it. We can have kids develop portfolios of their projects to show how their creations are developing over time. We can see how kids are developing through what it is that they create. So that's the way I would assess. It's important to gather evidence that kids are learning, but we need a different type of evidence.
Okay, so then give me an example, and I don't know if this is one that exists in real life or we can create one. Like, what would an ideal fourth grade classroom, or I'm just throwing out, you can pick any grade you want, but experience look like if we took the tenets of project, passion, peers, and play and infused them into the child's experience?
Well, I'll give an example of a workshop that we were involved with where kids were using all sorts of materials, and the challenge was to invent something that would be meaningful to them in their everyday life. And there was, one girl built a house for her pet gerbil, and then used a sensor and a motor so that the door would open automatically because she wanted to make a nice house for her gerbil. And then she started wondering, what is the gerbil doing during the day while she's at school? So she wrote a little computer program to count every time the door opened and shut so she could find out what it is, what her pet was doing. Now, this fourth grader wouldn't have been interested in a course in data collection and analysis, but she was interested in what her gerbil was doing during the day. And in the process of doing that, she was learning about data collection and analysis.
Oh, I see. So the passion comes from wanting to build a nice house for her gerbil.
Yeah, and knowing to know what her pet was doing. But it's important for kids to learn a wide range of things in school, but I see them learning it, if they learn it through the context of a meaningful project, they'll make deeper connections to the ideas and understand them in a richer way.
Yeah. So what's the role for teachers then here in this kind of context?
So too often people see teachers as the person who delivers the information. And too often education is thought of delivering instruction and delivering information. And I think teachers do need to play a different role. They still play an incredibly important role. It's not that kids are going to learn all of these things on their own. But the teacher plays more the role of a catalyst to spark the ideas, plays the role of a consultant to help kids sort through when things go wrong and to help them overcome through the challenges that they face. They play the role of a connector to help kids connect with others who could help them in what they're doing. So there's this wide range of different roles that teachers play, but more coaching, catalyst, connector, collaborator, as opposed to the person delivering information or delivering instruction.
So I don't mean to sound too much like too didactic here, too strict in my thinking. But what about all those folks out there who might be hearing this and saying, Professor Resnick, there has to come a time, though, where we need to be sure that, like, my child knows algebra, or that my child has read Shakespeare and understands it, you know, like that there are certain standards that have to be met. How can this model achieve those standards?
Well, I do think there's certain things that are important for children to learn. I might change the list. I'm not sure the current list that's out there of what we think kids should learn.
I was just throwing those out there, yeah.
But there are things that we do want children to learn. I do think one of the roles for teachers is to help create an environment where kids will work on projects where they engage with those ideas in a natural and meaningful way. Like another example where, we have a programming language called Scratch that we've developed that allows kids to create their own interactive stories and games and animations.
Early coding, essentially.
Yes, yeah. They're programming and coding. Yeah. But in the context, they learn all sorts of things. Like there was one boy that was working on a project creating a game, but he wanted to keep score in the game. So to help him see how to keep score, I showed him how you can create a variable that keeps score. And he was so excited that his game could now keep score. He shook my hand and said, thank you, thank you. And I started thinking, I wonder how my algebra teachers are thanked by their students for teaching them about variables. So that was a case that he was really ready to learn about variables. He wanted to learn about variables because it was meaningful to him. So I think we want to try to find the situations where kids can learn these important ideas in the context of meaningful projects. Otherwise, you can deliver the instruction in class, and it's not going to connect to them in a meaningful way.
Yeah. I presume you've talked to a lot of educators and worked with a lot of teachers and administrators in your years at the Lifelong Kindergarten Lab. I mean, what's their response when you say, hey, just try this?
Yeah. I do think there are a lot of teachers who, in a very personal way, resonate with these ideas. But sometimes they felt constrained within the current school system that they aren't able to carry out these ideas. I think these ideas make intuitive sense to a lot of educators, but they have all these other constraints that they need to satisfy in the current system. When they see there's an opportunity for doing things differently, they embrace that. A lot of them do embrace that idea. And it's a change in the way they would teach. But they see it as liberating and a great opportunity. But it's often difficult to do this in the constraints of the current system. Yeah. If we want kids to work on projects, if you have 50-minute class periods, it's not always easy to finish. So you might have to change the structure of the school day. You might have to break down barriers between different disciplines. You might need to have children of different ages interact with each other. So there's many things that need to change.
Well, the book is Lifelong Kindergarten, Cultivating Creativity Through Projects, Passion, Peers, and Play. It's from MIT professor Mitchell Resnick. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great talking with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Finally, today, we want to usher you into the weekend with a reflection on the challenges and mysteries of pregnancy. And it comes from Modern Love, a WBUR and New York Times podcast adapted from the popular Times column. You're going to hear an essay. It's written by David Lavsa, and it explores the emotional terrain of pregnancy, what that can feel like when things go right and when they go wrong. Actor Sterling K. Brown reads this story. It's called My First Son, A Pure Memory.
Having waited until we were in our 30s to start a family, my wife and I were having trouble conceiving, leading to sperm tests, hormone shots, and other extraordinary measures. Over many months, the process of conception became so technical that when Lisa told me she was at last pregnant, I found it hard to know what to credit. After the first ultrasound, she came home with a black and white picture of a tiny, curled-up creature. We put it on the refrigerator. My son, the lima bean. At 20 weeks, we went in together for the second ultrasound. The technician made small talk and popped his gum as he dimmed the lights. Lisa lay back on the table. I shifted in my seat, jammed my hands into my pockets, and stretched out my legs like a teenager settling in to watch a movie. As the technician slid the paddle around on Lisa's belly, The image on the computer screen wheeled, dipped, and blurred. Finally, my son's image popped into focus. Arms and legs folded, he seemed to be resting on his back, as if lying on the bottom of a pool, waiting to spring to the surface. The technician muttered something, hit a button to freeze the image, and walked briskly out of the room. A few minutes later, in walked a small man wearing a rumpled white coat and steel-rimmed glasses, his bow tie askew. He shut the door behind him. I don't remember exactly what he said. He looked as if someone had left him out in the rain. What we had taken for a frozen image, he explained, was in fact absolute stillness. We still referred to the man as Dr. Death, always sad, always breaking bad news. They keep him in a closet somewhere. A year later, pregnant with our second son, Benjamin, my wife turned a corner at the hospital and saw him at a nurse's station. She did an abrupt, involuntary about-face. After Dr. Death left, our midwife arrived to explain that we had a decision to make. Did we want to schedule a D&C, or did we want to induce labor? Her language was very plain, but it took a while for me to understand what she was really asking. Did we want the pregnancy to end in a surgical procedure in the outpatient clinic or in the maternity ward as a stillbirth? We asked whether there were medical advantages or disadvantages to either choice. She told us it was simply a matter of preference. No hurry. Let us know. On the drive home, we were mostly silent. As if exchanging telegrams, Lisa and I said what we needed to and no more. We each assumed there was only one possible decision, so when we talked logistics, appointments to reschedule, job responsibilities to manage. We asked questions we might have asked the midwife about recovery time. Then we realized we weren't in agreement. I was talking about the DNC, while Lisa had decided to give birth. Incredulous, I asked why she would want to go through all that pain. She said she couldn't imagine just getting rid of our child by a surgical procedure. She wanted to see him. So I had to ask myself, why didn't I want to meet my own son? We pulled into the driveway, phoned the hospital, turned around and drove back. Going to the hospital for a stillbirth is the photographic negative of going for a live birth. You carry the overnight bag, check into a room in the maternity ward, and so on. But they put a marker on your door to alert the nurse midwives that, in this room, things are different. As a means of inducing labor in a body that is not yet ripe, Pitocin is brutally effective. But it can take a while to kick in. After an hour of flipping through magazines, Lisa and I decided to take a walk. The nurse said it might speed things along. Wandering about in the midwinter dusk, Seattle sinking to the bottom of the gray scale, we were about a quarter mile from the hospital, just about to turn around when the drug took hold, doubling Lisa over. We considered calling a cab, but she decided she could make it. So we stumbled back with her arm around my shoulders for support. By the time we reached Lisa's room, her contractions were frequent and prolonged, much more so than they would have been at the early stages of a natural labor, and each surge of pain seemed to levitate her body above the sheets. When at last the anesthesiologist gave her an epidural, Lisa sighed and fell back into the pillows. Within an hour, she was asleep, and shortly after that, I dozed off as well, like a lab curled up in an armchair at the foot of her bed. My first son was born sometime in the gray dawn. In such cases, there's no rupturing of waters. The birth sac slips out whole and unbroken. The bag was a little bigger than my fist. The midwife put it on a towel and, with a small pair of scissors, carefully snipped it open. She unfolded our son's limbs, disentangling one from the other, unfurling him like a new leaf, talking softly to us all the while, describing him. He was about 5 inches long, she said. He was anencephalic, which means his brain and nervous system had failed to develop. He had probably died about a week earlier. Gingerly, she handed him to Lisa, and though it was clear that Lisa wanted to hold him longer, it was only a minute or two before she passed him to me. Later, Lisa told me she was afraid he would come apart in her hands. Resting on my outstretched hand, he was thin, nearly weightless, his skin pinkish-gray and translucent. He seemed to me less like a small baby than a scale model of a stripling child. I cradled his head between the ends of my middle and ring fingers, his features peaceful, perfect, blank. His feet reaching nearly to my wrist, his toes were like mine and my father's, the second toe longer than the big toe. When we got back from the hospital, the epidural had not quite worn off, so Lisa did not have the full use of her legs and clung to me as we staggered up the front steps. Thinking of ourselves as a public spectacle, how must we look to the neighbors, drunk again, we burst out laughing. Once inside, the bleak humor continued. Anencephalic? All right, so he won't go to Harvard. It wasn't until I had settled Lisa onto the couch that my own legs quit working. I was in mid-sentence, something about an errand, tea kettle in hand, halfway between the tap and the stove. A spasm went through me. I doubled over and I heard my own voice howling from far off, the full-throated cry of a child. On the day I went back to the small college where I work, I felt myself in another kind of altered state, not above the flow of daily life, but just below its surface, heavy, settled. Still, I'd been thinking about how to tell people, my colleagues, my students. Some knew that Lisa and I had been expecting a child. Clearly, I had to tell them what happened. Others didn't know about the pregnancy, though. Should I spring the whole story on them all at once? When a parent dies, or a partner, when we lose someone who has lived in the world, there are customs, worn paths to follow, ways to talk about it. But I didn't see any paths with this. Was I supposed to keep quiet and pretend nothing had happened? I couldn't accept that. So I typed out an email message, brief and plain, explaining Lisa had been pregnant, the child had died, and we took some comfort from the belief that all he had ever known was love. I stared at the screen for a long time. Then I clicked on the top of the email program and addressed the message to everyone at the college. Faculty members, students, staff, people I knew well, people I didn't know at all. I had a fleeting thought that this might be inappropriate, but then I pressed send. It felt like a form of protest. I wasn't really looking for a response. I just wanted to get the news out. I couldn't bear to repeat it over and over. And although my department's administrative assistant did field a few complaints about receiving something so personal by a general message, who is this guy? Most apparently understood, or at least excused, my gesture. And then came the outpouring. For weeks after, people I barely knew would come into my office, gently shut the door, and burst into tears. I heard stories of single and serial miscarriages, pregnancies carried nearly to full term, stillbirths. All the lost, lost children. Grief hauled about and nowhere to put it down. Some said they had never told anyone. Who would understand? My first son is like the faintest scar on my skin now, nearly hidden. Over time, will the mark disappear as my skin becomes mottled and wrinkled? Lisa was planning to bury his ashes, about a teaspoonful, in the garden, part of which was to be his. Instead, she kept his ashes in the bedside table drawer, right next to her, as if afraid he would wake in the night and need her. She felt him close to her, a wisp of spirit, the smallest presence. When Benjamin was very young, just beginning to speak in sentences, he asked if he had a brother once. Lisa paused a moment before answering, but by the time she started to speak, he had moved on to something else.
Sterling K. Brown, reading David Lovsa's modern love essay, My First Son, A Pure Memory. You can find out more information about the Modern Love podcast at radioboston.org. Definitely check it out. That's it for today and for this week. Have a peaceful weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.